plus The Muppets Rebooted, and David Cronenberg on Sigmund Freud.
The film programme was presented by Francine Stock. The producer was Craig Smith. Apparently, if you want to have lots of friends, then you need to have a bigger brain. We'll find out more in a moment. And the last of the So You Want to Be a Scientist finalists plans to study emotional responses to art. Material World is after we've heard about today's PM with Eddie Mair.
At 5 o'clock, we'll hear the latest from Egypt, where there have been sackings after that football violence, which left scores of people dead, but also questions about what caused the violence in the first place. Also, the Leveson Inquiry hears how the press treated one family after a stabbing incident. We'll discuss calls for sugar to be treated like alcohol or tobacco. And we'll have the latest on Chris Huhne, the cabinet minister who allegedly had his ex-wife accept speeding penalty points on his behalf. He denies wrongdoing. We expect to hear soon whether he'll be prosecuted. Join me if you can in half an hour.
Thanks, Eddie. Now on Radio 4, it's time to join Quentin Cooper for Material World.
Hello. So there goes January, pretty mild all things considered. But when we last had a long cold spell, the so-called Little Ice Age, which lasted until the mid-19th century, no one knows exactly when and why it began. We'll look at a new study that claims to have the answers. Is there a way to bypass the hype and the tripe and make an objective measurement of the worth of a piece of art? One of our So You Want to Be a Scientist's finalists thinks there is. We'll hear from him later. And not so much the material world as the world of real mates. Could the number of true friends you have be linked to the size of a particular bit of your brain? First, thank you for telling us all about yourself in microscopic detail. Now, would you like to know what we're planning on doing with all that personal information? And might you perhaps like a say in that? In the last decade, many of us have freely given our time and our cellular samples to help with genetic research. Having enabled a wealth of insights to be accumulated, what rights, if any, should such volunteers have to that data and how it's used, even when it reveals something about their own health? Until now, no one's apparently thought to ask those who provide it, the public, about how, when, and what genetic details should be shared. But a new online survey is attempting to correct that. And it comes hot on the heels of a report from the Human Genomics Strategy Group on how the health service can make better use of genomics. To discuss both, I'm joined on a line from Cambridge by Dr. Anna Middleton, a genetic counsellor and ethics researcher at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. And on another line is Alistair Kent, director of Genetic Alliance UK. Anna Middleton, we'll get on to the ethics, but for anyone who hasn't kept up since we first sequenced the human genome over 10 years ago, we've made huge strides since then, and volunteers have helped provide the genetic material to do that.
Yes, indeed, that's true. And it has actually been considered really good practice for a number of years to conduct genomic research anonymously. So people very kindly and altruistically give their samples and the genomic researchers would explore their DNA and look to discover new findings. But now the technology is such that you can look across all 20,000 genes in one go, relatively cheaply and quickly. And so the scientists can have access to an awful lot of quite personal data about research participants. And so there's been a bit of a shift in thinking about that contract, really, and starting to look at, well, what actually do research participants want to know, if anything, from their genome? And is it the duty of the researchers to start sharing that data?
Alistair Kent, before we can bring you on this properly, can you better explain what Genetic Alliance UK is?
Yes, we're the alliance of patient organisations. We represent something like 150 different patient organisations supporting individuals and families with all types of genetic diseases. So we're interested in the research and also in the translation of that research into improved help for families who currently live with serious and life-limiting conditions.
And it'll be a lot of people within these groups who are the kind of people who are volunteering for exactly what Anna's talking about, often volunteering anonymously.
Yes, and for many years individuals, families with genetic disease have contributed samples, as you say, for the furtherance of research and in the hope that the research will lead to treatments and cures.
But how do you get around this thing that if there is now the information that comes out, say, you know, a study's looking at one particular area, but they happen to stumble upon genetic information that indicates something quite serious about an individual, if that individual had known that was likely in the first place, they might never have volunteered. How do you get the balance right between telling people what they need to know and frightening them off?
I think it's a matter of being aware of the possibility and of giving people a chance to choose if something comes up as a result of their providing a sample, if it's possible to predict that there's a serious disease perhaps ahead of them. If people know that that's a possibility, they can choose whether or not they want to have that information should it be turned up by the research.
So, Anna, this is all down to what people know they're in for when they volunteer, what people's expectations are, and how that information is managed, and how, if necessary, they're counselled.
Yeah, that's very true. And the consenting process is obviously incredibly important. And what we're looking at now is new genomic studies, you know, to think about what should we be offering and what should be covered in the consent. But what's actually prompted a lot of this is that in the past, genomic research has been conducted quite separately from health services. And now there's much more of a link between genomic researchers and clinicians, basically. So where the health service currently cannot offer genetic testing for certain things, you may be able to get it in a research setting. And so that's brought researchers and clinicians closer together. And so now for the first time, there's real consideration to sharing data, and particularly if families with certain, you know, really serious genetic conditions want an answer and the NHS can't offer it, research projects may be able to do that. And so, you know, it's actually seen as quite a good thing to try and share answers to a missing diagnosis. Basically.
So how's this survey going to help with this?
Well, it's one thing offering answers to a missing diagnosis, but it's another thing offering lots of incidental information that could also be discovered from the genome. And there's massive discussion. This is being debated worldwide at the moment about where you draw the line with what you share and what's ethical to share. And policy is popping up all over the place about this, with this sort of idea that it's ethically a good thing to be sharing more and more data. And yet none of this policy is actually based on any large-scale empirical research that's actually asked people what they want to know. And so our study at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute is really hopefully going to be one of the first and the largest to really explore what do people want to know. And the interesting thing that we've found is that if you say to people, do you want to know stuff about your genome? The first answer is often, oh, yes, of course. If people have knowledge about me, then yes, I'd want to know it. But then when you start to unpick, you know, what kind of information would they want to know? How would that be delivered? Might that mean for them? Yes, it gets more complicated and often people change their minds.
Alistair, having worked with 150 patient groups, you've probably got a sense of what people are likely to say for this?
I think the answer is it all depends. Some people will want to know absolutely everything. Others would perhaps want to know if something is picked up that can be altered or treated or prevented. Others will not want to know, will just want to let nature take its course. I think crucial element of this research is that for the first time people are being asked how they think they want their information handled. And I think this is a very important and encouraging development, because it's basing policy on people's real experience and expectations, not the hypothetical judgments that professionals make about what patients think or might want to do.
And briefly, perhaps, Alistair, if we are moving to an era of personal genomics, we should be able to have personal genomic information management as well.
That's the goal. Of course, we're some way from that in terms of understanding the complexity of our genome, but obviously, in the fullness of time, if we keep doing the research, then maybe we will move to that position.
OK, Alistair Kent, Dr. Anna Middleton, thank you both. I should say there is a link to the survey on our website, and anyone can take part. Forget numbers of Christmas cards received, how many LinkedIn connections they have, or how many Facebook friends they've accumulated. If you really want a measure of someone's popularity and how good they are at maintaining those friendships, then just look them in the eyes and then up a bit and into their brain and measure the size of their prefrontal cortex. A new study seems to show that the larger your prefrontal cortex, a term, by the way, coined by the same Richard Owen, who also gave us the word dinosaur, then the larger your network of pals. Now, does that mean some of us are physiologically predisposed to have more friends? Or is it that the more we end up with, the bigger that bit of our brain gets? The study's leader is my old chum, Robin Dunbar, Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at Oxford. Well, he's not really an old chum, but he has been on the programme before. And when I spoke to him earlier, we began with this problem of how he defined friend, given that for different people it can mean anything from a bosom buddy to a nodding acquaintance.
What we actually did with the subjects was simply ask them to list on a piece of paper all the people that they'd seen socially in the last week and as it were, made an effort to see. We didn't want them to sort of list casual acquaintances that they'd met at a party and will never see again and had never seen before, but people that they felt they had some kind of relationship with.
So not just people who followed you on Twitter or you met for 10 minutes and then added as a Facebook friend. There's got to be some lasting connection.
Yes, yes.
And what made you initially think this particular bit of the brain might have something to do with all this?
We'd done some previous work which had shown that what's known as the mentalizing network, which involves the prefrontal cortex with some bits in the temporal cortex and is sort of quite well understood and is involved in this capacity to understand how other people are thinking, basic sort of social skills, really, that involves that circuit. And we're kind of interested in, well, that's the kind of thing that five-year-old children do. So it's, in some senses, not very interesting. What do adults do? You know, can we sort of scale it up and see what actually happens in terms of both the level of skills to which adults can rise in this particular context and how that correlates with the total number of friends?
Now, you use this word mentalizing. I think we're going to need to nail that one down a bit.
It is this ability to understand what somebody else is thinking and indeed to see you from their perspective. To be able to differentiate between the fact that you have one view of the world and they have a different one. So it allows you to kind of coordinate your interactions with them.
All right, I think I understand. It's a bit like the Kurzel Flyers song, Little Does She Know That I Know That She Knows That I Know She's Two-Timing Me. 1976, in the top 20, can't remember exactly where. So what did you do with your volunteers?
Very simple. We just got them to fill in a questionnaire of their friends. We got them to do a series of little tasks of these kind of mind-reading, mentalizing-type tasks, which allowed us to see how good they were on these tasks and to sort of have a number which we could attach to that, and then stuck them in the brain scanner and measured the size of their heads.
And you found a fairly straightforward relationship?
A very nice relationship. I mean, these things are always very messy at the best of times, but there's a very significant correlation. But what was really interesting is that it's actually not sort of completely straightforward, and that what seems to happen is this particular part of the prefrontal cortex correlates with your mentalizing skills, your mind reading skills, and in turn, your mind reading skills determine the number of friends you have. So it's a real causal sequence.
Just to be clear, are you suggesting that as we develop more friendships, this bit of our prefrontal cortex swells, or that if we happen to have a large prefrontal cortex, then we're predisposed to have more friends? And if we don't, we won't.
I think by the time you get to your and my age, we're stuck with it.
Right.
The big and interesting question, in a way, is whether these skills can develop, as it were, during childhood and teenagehood. And if you practice them more, that bit of the brain will get bigger. And it's that period during the teens up until the early 20s that's probably critical in this particular context, because the frontal lobes in particular of the brain don't finally stabilize until you're about your mid-20s.
Going back to the study and being mischievous, one thing that occurs to me is, how do you check on participants' claims about how many social interactions they had? Might it not be the case that this prefrontal cortex size is linked with how boastful they are rather than how popular?
That's perfectly possible. We have kind of two checks, if you like. One is, we've spent a lot of the last 10 years asking people endlessly